Thank you very much to the Observatoire for inviting me to speak today, and particularly to Miriam and the rest of the team who've taken such good care of us and made us feel very welcome. So this talk was initiated today with many social science colleagues working on HIV, who you can see here. Oh, sorry about the disrupted slides. Too many names all got merged together. My apologies. So this is a modified version of a talk that I gave last year to the International Association of HIV and AIDS Care Providers. IAPAC is the acronym used. And so just to give you a sense of what I'll be covering in the next 30 minutes, first of all, I probably don't need to go into much detail, but just a brief mention of definitions and terminologies, because as Charlotte said at the beginning, we use these acronyms TASP. It means many things to many different people in terms of what's included, what's not included. There's also some discussion about the impact of the meaning of those concepts. I'll go through some discussion around the methodological and epistemological contrasts. As a sociologist, my approach to these issues will be quite a contrast, perhaps, to the previous papers. I'm interested in looking at what the social science research agenda needs to be in relation to these matters, and also raising a place for skepticism and actually reviving a concept of skepticism that I think perhaps we've lost in current times. And basically to make the argument that in the next 5 years, social research is needed that will situate treatment as prevention generally in their relevant social contexts, just as we've been discussing already, including what's happening in the international arena with these global level international studies, as well as the particular level social realities of policy, payment, social reimbursement, as well as the lived realities for people in different cultural and social contexts. So just in terms of talking about treatment as prevention, to go through this question of sort of definition and what I'll be focusing on today. I'm aware of a discussion leading into a paper by the Global Network of People Living with HIV, where they they've gotten rid of the term treatment as prevention, and they are adopting the term ARVs for prevention instead, in order to sort of remove this notion of the treated individual being the person who is then responsible for prevention. So already, it helps us consider these potential shifts for meaning in the terminologies that we arrive at. And I don't need to go through, obviously, all the evidence, which has already been covered so well this morning. I also think it's worth spending some time recognizing that when people talk about treatment as prevention, or ARVs for prevention, this can, but not always, include PEP and PrEP as part of that discussion. Certainly in the UK, PEP is available to people who want it, particularly who are going on an emergency basis, either to accident and emergency clinics or to a sexual health clinic. Those are the most likely places where you would get PEP. I can't say that universally that request will be met. It depends on how well those teams are equipped. Sexual health clinics certainly are well equipped, but there's still anecdotal evidence that it can be a challenge in accident and emergency clinics. With the case with PrEP, as of yesterday, the PROUD trial that's being undertaken among men who have sex with men in the UK to establish acceptability as well as efficacy of PrEP among men who have sex with men. Yesterday, the PROUD study announced, and I've put the link there so that you can look at the announcement if you like, that they're discontinuing the deferred treatment arm of that study because of elevated seroconversion in the group who were in the deferred arm. These things are changing day by day. I think it was mentioned briefly again this morning by Charlotte. There's quite a move towards looking at when the pandemic will end and an AIDS-free generation and the rhetoric around the end of the epidemic by 2030. People will put different years on the goal. Others are very circumspect about the veracity of the evidence that might get us there, despite the fact that we all know we'd like to get there. There's no disagreement about that. So some of the issues raised are that new HIV prevention technologies such as these are being pitched as clinical interventions, where both the effectiveness and the compliance of a largely passive population of people who have HIV or who are at risk of HIV, that compliance is often assumed or built into some of these concepts. And for me, I think we need to explore that point of tension and we need to interrogate it rather than look away from it. So I want to step back for a moment and just have us think about technologies that aren't about HIV, but that are sexual health technologies. So, think of each of them. We've got the contraceptive pill. We have Gardasil, which is the vaccine for HPV. We have hepatitis B vaccines, the good old condom, and IUD, intrauterine devices. Just take a moment, actually, with your own backgrounds and expertise and experience and knowledge of these histories to think about what would the path to optimal implementation have looked like when each of these came out? What were the conferences? What were the discussions? What were the debates that were being had at that time? And contrast that in each of these cases with how far we are from optimal implementation. The proof of efficacy, the fact that these things work, of course we know that these things work, but the reality on the ground involves people and lives and messiness and controversy and politicians and all of those aspects that we have to get to grips with. And that started to emerge during that short part of the debate after the previous presentation. This is the place where we work. So it is these systems of social meaning that mold the progress of each of these new technologies. And I think it's worth us considering what we're talking about now with treatment as prevention or ARVs as prevention in light of these histories that we know. If you think about some of those social contexts, think about the moral judgments that are cast on the types of people who may be considered to need such protection. Think about in the history of the contraceptive pill, the fights that the feminists had in terms of making the argument against their detractors that you weren't a prostitute or a whore if you wanted a pill, that you were still a morally upstanding woman and you had a right to that choice. These discussions are happening with PrEP today. These discussions are happening with treatment as prevention today. We need to link these histories and learn from them and remember them and talk to the people who are part of those histories for their insights. People will question having each of these things inside of them for the right or the wrong reasons and how we challenge those perceptions about the medicalization of the individual need to go into our conceptualization of how we approach these issues. Considering structures of hierarchy and privilege in terms of who has access to such technologies and should they be restricted only to those who are responsible enough to manage them is a question that I think we're starting to touch on, that people in clinical roles are feeling like they have the burden of having to manage that load of who's responsible enough and how do I manage my legal liability and professional responsibility in light of those thoughts around my patients' levels of responsibility. And are those the right questions to be considered? Really, I think that there's a tension here that often doesn't get enunciated, and often that happens in the interest of what we call interdisciplinarity, and we'd rather not unpack the problems that we face. But in the social sciences and in the physical sciences, we need to be honest about the fact that we function often from very different theoretical and ethical bases. We come at our common problems from really different worldviews. On the one hand, the physical sciences have to strip away the divergence of human experience, the messiness of that practical world. On the other side, in social sciences, that's precisely what we're interested in looking at. We're looking for messy. We're looking for difficult and contrasting and divergent experience. And yet at the same time, the physical scientists and the social scientists and, you know, community and policymakers are in a position where we have to sit down and work together and benefit from each other's understanding and value each other's understanding of the world. So I think that some of those questions that we have to ask in light of this relate to, you know, what can a randomized control trial achieve? What can it not achieve? We're already starting to look at this now. How do we meaningfully move from the demonstrations of efficacy within a trial setting to effectiveness in the real worlds of the populations that we seek to influence? And what can we agree on as a meaningful cause and effect analysis, and what is not? So taking that approach to things, I think a social science research agenda needs to interrogate questions around ARVs for prevention about who's being best served by these policy changes and who's being least served. What role does social inequality have? What are the roles of social organizations and institutions and the internal organization within social institutions that play a part in this? And so I just want to sort of start off by taking us through the notion of the randomized control trial itself. So an RCT environment is one that produces evidence in a highly protected, highly resourced, cushioned, monitored, privileged environment. Something like, it's quite dark to see, but something like a child, a baby, in an incubator in the center there. They're in that swaddled incubator being carefully protected, and I'm using that as a reflection of what we might call an RCT environment. That incubator is not a long-term solution for that child, and once they emerge from it, that child faces a whole new set of developmental challenges to ensure that it flourishes. That means it needs material resources, a supporting, nurturing environment, and it also needs support from social systems. I've got a sort of government council chamber there. And it also needs some support from institutions like a school or a nursery. You know, there's a whole host of resources that are required once that protected environment is removed for that particular individual. And so now that the evidence around ARVs for prevention has emerged from what we might see as the incubator of the RCT, and before that, you know, the Swiss statement, we get nowhere if we believe that somehow that intervention is meant to implement itself. Effectively, this is going to speed faster than I can talk, I'm just going to let it happen. We need to consolidate our understanding of all of those complex interactions between the treatments and the community level histories. I've got images there of people protesting against drug companies, for example. This is a part of the reality of what people are talking about in their collective memories, their personal experience, often their colonialized experience of Western interventions as well. We need to look at the impact of supportive relationships and social networks and how that interacts with treatment as prevention, the institutional systems for delivering drugs, who pays for it and how, and the political structures, where is the will to actually make that happen. So there's considerable evidence already accruing about what's been happening with ARVs for prevention in everyday experience. Wilson describes, and I have a list of references at the end, Wilson describes how in high-income countries with enviable testing rates and clinical access for people in the most affected populations, these natural experiment grounds for ARVs for prevention are falling well short of what was anticipated. In England, where I work, Public Health England have estimated that among all people with HIV in 2011, if we look back at the historic data then, among all people with HIV, diagnosed and undiagnosed, 58% of them had an undetectable viral load. For the same year, the Centers for Disease Control in the US put their rate at 28%. So you're looking at, you know, two high-income countries with, you know, very strong infrastructures around them, very different circumstances and situations. In direct response to that kind of challenge, the latest United Nations UNAIDS gap report promotes the 90-90-90 goal. Can I just ask if people are familiar with that? Who's heard of 90-90-90? Okay, that's really interesting. Two hands. it's worth, this is going to be a new mantra that will be heard. If you heard of 3x5 or, you know, sort of those kind of UN level target goals, this is the next one. It's coming. It's worth looking on the UNAIDS website. So the goal is 90% of all people with HIV will be diagnosed, of whom 90% are then on treatment and in clinical contact, of whom 90% achieve an undetectable viral load. So that's a percentage of a percentage of a percentage. That works out to 73%. So ultimately, that's a goal of 73% of all people with HIV having an undetectable viral load. I think they have a year date in mind for that. Is it 2020? Yeah, by 2020. So these are the kinds of, you know, that's a political goal, an international level goal, but we need to kind of think about what is the actual resourcing and institutional structure and mobilization that's required to get there. These are all questions that need some considerable working out. Many people will be familiar with this notion of the treatment cascade. And it's being, you know, kind of discussed, and it's kind of a new package for a set of very old ideas that we, I think, have all been working on in HIV for a long time. But it's a useful metaphor. So Gardner and Wilson and many others have used this concept to describe the essential component of clinical interaction that you need at each and every stage, and you can consider this for test and treat as a cascade. You could also consider it for PrEP as a cascade, and people are starting to discuss what the PrEP cascade looks like. You also actually can implement this kind of cascade for PEP as well, because you have to test at the initiation of PEP. So it's a useful framework because it covers the social and structural and contextual components of individual and population level engagement with these technologies. What's often asserted in discussions that I'm seeing about the cascade is that the first entry point is massive increases in routine periodic HIV testing. And then there's a hope that once that happens, ARVs will follow and it's all going to happen and fall into line. And yet perceiving that the cascade and what creates it as just a clinical puzzle that has to be solved in a very straightforward, first we do this, then we do this sort of way, is quite narrow-sighted. As Vin Kim Noyan and other social scientists have pointed out, there's an enormous amount of complexity feeding into each of these stages down the cascade. And it's starting to get packaged together in places where I'm attending, people are calling the solutions to this should be based in implementation science. But it's a little bit of a mystery to me. People aren't unpacking this notion of implementation science and what it entails. But I'm wondering if to some extent that's also a repackaging of the many, many things that many of us have been doing. And I'd be interested to hear what people have to say about that in the discussion. And then, of course, there's questions of affordability, geographic access, and everyday complex issues that you can situate within this cascade, including ongoing marginalization of sex workers and marginalization of people who inject drugs and undocumented migrants, shrinking budgets for the provision of social and practical support by people who actually need to be on medicine for their own health and well-being. And so if we look at some of the social science questions in this cascade, I just sort of want to step through them a little bit to look at what a social science agenda should start to look like. So first, in order for people to arrive for an HIV test, they have to know that it's safe and worthwhile to do that. So we need to reinvigorate our explorations of how HIV stigma maintains social inequalities through the oppression of women, through the oppression of racialized groups, men who have sex with men, people who inject drugs and trade sex. We need to look at how that stigma impacts on risk perception and service access. And without understanding that in local contexts, we can't even hope to start to get people to that beginning point of the cascade. So alongside this, we need to continually also collect information, as many of us have been doing quite well on, sort of injecting practices, partnering patterns, gender relations. They're always shifting. They're always changing. There's quite a lot of attention in the UK at the moment around injecting drug use among a small but significant cohort of men who have sex with men. So just because these data were collected 10 years ago doesn't mean that you don't keep collecting it. And understanding things about HIV literacy among populations. You know, all of these things change very quickly in relation to immediate lived circumstance in people's lives. Consider what it takes now to go for an HIV test in Russia or in Greece. I don't even know what's happening in Ebola-affected countries in relation to HIV, but I can only imagine that HIV prevention is not on the agenda right now in those locations. So situations can turn around quite dramatically, and keeping attention to the big and the small changes in those contexts are essential. So 30 years into our epidemic, there are a lot of lessons to be learned from all of those contexts of HIV prevention, treatment, care, and support. And actually, something that I'm interested in doing in our own context is looking back retrospectively through the qualitative and quantitative data that we hold. Because actually, there is an enormous amount of data that we already have around understandings of adherence, relationships of adherence patterns to various social demographic factors. And I think we're now at a point where we need to start looking back at the data that we hold rather than necessarily just feeling like we need to start fresh at the same time on all of these questions around ARVs for prevention. Because I actually think there is a lot of relevant information in our coffers, and we also need to be able to track progress over time in terms of what are people's understanding? How do we demonstrate how behavior has been influenced since the time of the Swiss statement? Are social scientists trying to build a set of measures that would help us understand that in any way, or can we make any claim for that? And should we try to? Moving on through the cascade, being successfully linked into care requires safe and meaningful integration of information, referral processes, lots of trust in the referring agencies, and that requires a lot of examination of what are the structural and the commercial, can't forget the drugs companies here, and the governmental and institutional determinants of service use. Further down in the cascade, we need to understand how social factors within the hospitals and clinics themselves, including social relations between staff, might attract patients or repel them. And even further down, we need to look at purchasing practices, treatment stockouts, hierarchies within government, business infrastructures. All of those issues need to be very clearly understood as the part of the cascade. And so, what I'm trying to do is say here, for the social scientists among us and for those of you who influence social sciences, it's not just, these questions aren't just about looking at the people who are expected to take the pills. We have to look at all of the structures around and within and between all of that. Enrollment and retention in care requires service users who believe that those services are valuable and that they can afford them and that they can attend them safely. So we have to start comparing what we know about what people think about the services that they use and whether or not there are differences between service user groups. In a study that I was involved with called Keeping Confidence, where we were actually looking to find out what HIV service providers in clinics and community settings thought about criminalization of HIV transmission, it was interesting because the topic of criminal liability was being introduced very differently to newly diagnosed patients by different clinicians working in the same place, and certainly between organizations. And there's little agreement, as we've just seen, on the role that criminal prosecutions might play in either increasing or decreasing individual responsibility for HIV transmission or contributing to elevated HIV-related stigma. And it's fascinating to me that in conversations around treatment as prevention, the embedded notions of responsibility and a concern about ultimately who is morally and by extension then legally liable for HIV transmission, these these conversations are increasingly conjoined. And so effectively, we need to look behind them and realize that what we're talking about here is what our understandings of responsibility are. Certainly, as a part of that study on criminal transmission, that topic of ARVs came up a lot amongst the service providers. And just moving further down through the cascade, we need to better understand the ways in which social factors in hospitals and clinics function, as I've just said. And you know, there's a lot of work that means that we have some understanding of what users or potential users of ARVs might think about ARVs for prevention. There's a very useful literature review undertaken by Young and McDade, and again, I have the reference at the end, in the journal AIDS and Behavior. And they found 33 studies that either looked at ARVs for prevention and oral PrEP and acceptability among the potential user groups. They found that PrEP studies largely focused on men who have sex with men only, and mostly in the US. And they found very diverse measures of acceptability. So there's not even any understanding of what we mean when we say people find this acceptable. And also that people felt that there were five areas, the review found that there were five areas in which further research is needed. The acceptability of treatment as prevention to people living with HIV, motivation for PrEP use and adherence, current perceptions and management of risk, the impact of broader social and structural factors, and a consistent definition and operationalization of acceptability that moves beyond just adherence. So there are a number of questions around that. I was going to take a moment to look at a bit of data, but actually I don't think we need to. Returning to the cascade, just in this last point, I just feel that there's some comparative frameworks that need to be looked at in terms of formative evaluation and process evaluation, as well as engagement with policy analysts, which I don't really think has been happening as much as it could do in HIV, as well as economic cost benefits analysis, so that we can start to measure what success looks like across a whole range of factors that aren't just about HIV incidence. We need to look at HIV incidence as a clear clinical outcome, but it's often very hard to draw a line between, you know, some distal issue that is raised in policy over there and HIV incidence. And so actually, how in the social sciences are we joining together and making sense of the measures that we build together so that we understand what success is on the way to HIV incidence being decreased as a result of our combined efforts? And finally, social researchers have a role to play in identifying and testing pathways to implementation that are locally relevant. So on the one hand, I'm sort of discussing the fact that social science sits away from physical science or RCTs to some extent and unpacks the issues around them. But also then we have a responsibility to be a part of the randomized control trials and look very plainly and play a role in what happens with implementation and how it works and how we can make sure implementation is ethically coherent. A discussion with a colleague of mine about the work of Isabel Stengers, who appropriately enough is Belgian, led me to look into her writing a bit more. She's a philosopher of science who trained as a chemist originally, and I found her works to be quite useful, quite inspiring in terms of understanding what she describes as slow science. It's an approach to scientific investigation that takes a range of perspectives and analytical challenges into account. It's an approach that is steeped in daily acts of diplomacy, because it's through diplomacy that we're attuned to a broad range of potential outcomes and priorities rather than just our own. So what she's talking about is, rather than just focusing on our own perspective in our own work, that we need to take a wider viewpoint to acknowledge how entire systems and cultures and structures co-create reality. And so her notion of symbiosis was interesting to me, and she says symbiosis is always between heterogeneous beings, theorists and experimenters need each other, but their practice entertains diverging constraints and obligations, which means that an achievement or an interesting failure entails different consequences to each of those groups. And symbiosis is ultimately about a culture of divergence. And I think it's just worth considering then, culturally together, how we take these practices into account in the work that we're doing. And on my last slide, I just want to look forward to a discussion with you before I conclude about, you know, what those supportive roles in scientific inquiry are between the physical and the social sciences. There's a picture of Socrates here, who was a rather famous Greek skeptic. And he developed a system of learning through asking questions. The skeptics set out to examine how each new argument or piece of evidence suggested a new set of challenges and questions. And it was a central method of obtaining knowledge through systematic doubt and continual testing. That is at the center of what we now acknowledge as a scientific method. But it's fascinating to me that the use of the term skeptic now is regarded with such negative overtones. And it's, you know, and often someone who raises a question is dismissed as a skeptic, as though that's a bad thing. Social sciences work alongside the physical sciences to develop those pathways of inquiry. And that skepticism that I think we need to revive as a positive aspect needs to be delivered with respect for our mutual endeavor, and it needs to be received similarly. And I think that's where Stenger's notion of symbiosis and diplomacy really come into the fore. So that's going to generate some tricky questions. Some of those uncomfortable questions may be, what's happened to the place of informed consent when it comes to HIV testing and treatment? What does the world of HIV prevention look like when our primary intervention is test and treat, and most other behavioral interventions are deprioritized and unfunded? And what would the political implications be if it became widely perceived that the health of the herd was more important than the needs of the individual? So those questions aren't easy, but I feel they're essential, as you know, there are a number of other questions we could come up with. I feel that skepticism needs to be revived as a value because challenge and disagreement create opportunities to generate those new understandings that I think we're all here to discuss. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much.